Tonight on Arena, Jan Carson on her new short story collection, Quickly While They Still Have Horses, and composer David Downes, poet Adam Wyeth on their new show, There Will Be No Silence. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Jan Carson is no stranger to Arena listeners, having shared with us insights into her most recent novel, The Raptures, and her previous, The Firestarters, both giving us an insight into the unionist and loyalist communities of Northern Ireland, and often using magic realism to explain the unexplainable. Jan is also a prolific short story writer. Her latest collection is called Quickly While They Still Have Horses. The collection is an exploration of many aspects of life. Childhood is in there, as is middle age, grief, falling in love, parenthood and loss, all told with Jan's trademark empathy, humour and a very striking imagination, it has to be said. Delighted that Jan joins me on the programme this evening. I wondered, Jan, you know, as I was reading through some of the stories and the kind of the dark areas that many of them go into, I thought, yep, Jan normally gives us nice dark stories with little twists all over the place. I have the impression that this one goes a little bit darker than usual. And I know some of the stories are from a while back. Did you have that sense when you gathered the 16 of them up?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know what's happened to me, Sean. I guess somebody today was telling me they really reminded them of the old Roald Dahl's, you know, his stories for grown-ups and, yeah, and tales from Spectre. And there is a bit of a macabre twist to some of them, but they were written over quite a period of time, so don't be worrying about me. I haven't just gone permanently dark.
No, and that's I was aware of that, you know, it wasn't as if you sat down and did these 16 stories all in one go, but you kind of compile them in a way that the darkness jumps to the fore. Even if I start with the very first story in the book, A Certain Degree of Ownership, to say that the woman at the centre of this is unpleasant, I think is possibly understating the fact. She's certainly not a social being, is she?
She's not, and she's having a wee crisis moment that I think we often have, not maybe not as dramatic as her, but where you start to think, you know what, I can't be bothered to sort out other people's problems. It's their fault. And she takes it really to the extremes here and then is left to deal with the consequences of what's happened because she hasn't intervened.
Yeah, just to give, we don't have to give the entire story, but the basic setup here is a woman on a beach, and along arrives a young family. But as far as this woman is concerned, this is my beach. How dare they come anywhere near me?
I mean, I'd be similarly territorial with the table that I write at coffee shops every morning. Somebody sits at it, I give them a death glare.
Well, I hope you don't go quite as far as our protagonist does in this book, in that particular story. But it did strike me from the outset, nothing and nobody is safe here. Young children, old people, weak people, sick people. Nobody is in a safe place. Again, I guess you don't write with that in mind, but what do you think brings that to the fore, Jan?
I guess I thought a lot about what pulls a collection together, and I think the overarching theme here is actually disappointment, which is not a terribly sexy theme to sell a short story collection, but you're meeting people at points in life where they're hitting a wee crisis of, you know, I thought my life would have turned out differently from this. And it can be very small in the everyday. There's an elderly couple queuing in a garden centre worrying that the scones are going to run out before they get to the end of the queue, and folks having to have their picnic in a car because the rain has started. So that's in the very small everyday moments. But I think underneath it, there's a kind of bigger sense of disappointment of, you know, we're sitting 26 years after the Good Friday Agreement, and these stories are very grounded in Northern Irish culture. And I guess I often think, you know, this isn't really the pace that I was sold at 18 in 1998. I'm a little bit disappointed with how things have turned out. So to me, that's the kind of theme that's hovering over all of these stories.
That's very interesting, because I was kind of in about five minds, well, probably if the truth be told, in 16 minds as to which story we would go to first. But you've brought up this idea of disappointment and the Good Friday Agreement. So I'm going to go get stuck into one-hander. Which is a wonderful title. If you give us the basic setup here, people will understand why One-Hander is such a good title for it.
So this story is about Laura, whose father and brothers are all loyalist paramilitaries, and she has decided it's not for her. She wants a different kind of life and has removed herself from that and is in a relationship with a Polish fella who's just moved to Northern Ireland. And she wakes up one morning and finds the red hand of Ulster is inside her fridge, great big bloody red hand. And at first she thinks this is some kind of threat, and then she realises that actually it is the actual red hand of Ulster. It's disappeared from every flag, every sign, every symbol in the country. And she's a little bit confused as to how to get rid of this thing that's in her fridge and why she's having to deal with it.
I did get the impression that while you might not be happy to wake up with a bloodied hand in your fridge of a morning, that you mightn't be that sad if... And I'm only saying the red hand of Ulster. It could be any emblem or any flag or any symbol, in fact. You wouldn't be too sad if some of those disappeared.
Yeah, I think it's a conversation starter. I've talked to quite a few people about that story, about what symbols have come to represent here. And often, you know, symbols are held up as things that have far too much importance attached to them. And really, we should be looking at some of the issues that are behind the symbols rather than the flags and the signs and things. But often, you know, communities under pressure here often feel they've nothing but symbols left to cling on to.
And I suppose if there's a message within the one-hander tale, he's a Polish guy. He's a Polish Catholic, if I have my facts right on that one. And she's from a Protestant community. It's this idea that, you know, in fact, coming together is going to be the only way forward.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot in that story thinking about, you know, how we hold on to the parts of our culture that are actually worth holding on to. And Laura in the story, like myself, is kind of ashamed and sad that she, you know, she grew up with a very Protestant education, unaware of Irish language, unaware of some of the myths from this place, the history of Ireland. And I think, you know, the Polish guy in this story has much more of a deep understanding of his own cultural heritage than Laura has. So that's it. There's a lot of me in that story in a way as well.
Yeah, and in fact, it is interesting that you bring that up since 2022. In fact, you're an Irish citizen. How difficult was that for you coming from the background that you do come from, Ballymena, I suppose, pretty much a loyalist and unionist stronghold within Northern Ireland, and the Protestant community in which you grew up, being an Irish citizen mightn't be at the top of most people's agenda in that situation?
Well, I think I'm the only Irish passport holder in my family at the minute. You know, it was a strange process, and I still feel like I'm in flux when it comes to identity. I'm not entirely sure what I am. I very, very strongly identify as an Irish writer, simply because it's such a wonderful community to be part of, such a generous, talented, inclusive community. And also I love the association with, you know, what it means to be an Irish writer and the weight of tradition that goes there. But there are parts of the British culture that I grew up with that I'm still drawn to. You know, I like Marks and Spencers. I like the BBC. I probably shouldn't be saying that on RTE, but there are little bits of British culture that are still very woven into who I am. Identity is such a complex thing. And, you know, I sometimes wonder what it really serves to force people to pin themselves down and neatly define themselves.
And well, look, the BBC is quite fine to mention. We're both public service broadcasters and we both want that type of broadcasting to continue. So long may both situations exist in that regard. Let me go to a story that is set within the Troubles itself. It's set in 1980. Is this the first time that you've gone that far back, or was that in some of the novels as well? Did you bring yourselves into the depths of that troubled period?
Is this Grand Sceau you're talking about?
Yes, Grand Sceau, yeah. The second story, in fact, isn't it? Yeah.
That's a very autobiographical one. It's about a young girl who is travelling around the border areas in the 80s with her grandmother, who's a rep for a luxury jam company, trying to sell it to shops. And inadvertently, she has bought a car with the ghost of the previous owner in the back seat, a Catholic gentleman. And My nana actually was a rep for a chicken company about that period. In the summer holidays, she used to take me with her in the car to go around the shops. And it wasn't until I was much later, Sean, that I realized why we would stop at phone boxes to phone home and let Granda know we were okay. But it probably wasn't the safest thing to be tootling around the borders in the mini metro in 1984 by yourself.
Yeah, and you say this is autobiographical because, funnily enough, when I read this story, I thought this has a real smell of something that actually happened off it. The
I
young, go ahead.
changed it from chicken fillets to luxury jam.
That's the only fictional bit, is it? The luxury jam.
Yeah.
Can I talk about the specifics of that? Because I think it's quite important. This you say it matter of factly. They bought a car with the ghost of the previous owner sitting in the back, and this young girl Ruth can she can speak to this ghost. She can ask him questions, and she does it the minute the granny gets out of the car. But there is an incredible moment when the ghost speaks to her and says, "You know, tell your granny not to go down that road now. Tell her to stop here." Do you mind telling us what ensues from that? Because it kind of stopped me in my tracks, to be honest with you, when I read it.
Yeah, it was funny because I didn't know that's how that story was going to end. You often write into a story, and I just began to write my memories of tootling about with Nana, and that ending came from nowhere. He really, the man in the back seat, really does save Ruth and her grandmother's life. They're about to drive into a bomb, and he directs them down a different road. And I guess I was being generous to Ruth in the story in a way that I didn't have that opportunity at her age, that she gets to meet somebody from the other side of the fence who, dispels some of the stereotypes that she's grown up with. It was a lot later for me before I had those conversations. Like, probably wasn't till I arrived at university at 18. But in a very similar way, I think Hannah, the young protagonist in The Raptures, was asking similar questions. And I'll probably come back to that theme
Yeah.
again because it's an important one.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, we talk of this dead ghost in the back of the car, and we talk about the hand in the fridge in the previous story, and how all the red hands have disappeared off the flags, the Ulster flag, and similarly in Quickly While They Still Have Horses, the title story, all the horses, there are no more horses in the world, and there's a kind of magic realism that is constantly present in your work, and the raptures, even that sound, that sense, that word, the raptures, has that feel off it. You link that in, I think, directly to your Presbyterian background.
There's lots of different reasons I'm a magical realist. I mean, you said at the header of the show about having too much imagination. I think that's one of the reasons. I do think there is a link. Like, I believe that all writers have what I would call a primary storytelling language, you know, how they learnt to tell stories. And that could be from your drunk Uncle Kevin, who tells a great story at a wedding, or it could be the Celtic myth cycles. I learned from the Bible, and I think in some ways the Bible is a magical realist text in that it's set in the real world, and then these strange things happen, you know, the miraculous, the apocalyptic, the parables. And I just, when I began to write, that felt like the most natural way for me to write. But there's so many links with magical realism and colonial issues and places that have experienced colonialism. And I often wonder why we don't have more of it here in Ireland. It's a really rich vein to tap into.
Yeah, I guess, and particularly with the community that you come from, it's very easy to link this into what might be called, you know, Southern Gothic, as in the Southern states of America. I can see links between your writing and that, and I'm guessing that's part of the type of story that you would love to read.
Yeah, shall I read a wee bit now for you?
Yeah, if you would, please.
I'll just give a wee bit of context. So this story is called Quickly While They Still Have Horses. The protagonist lives in England, and he has a Spanish girlfriend who he's been trying to get to visit Northern Ireland for a long time, and she's been reluctant to come. And then she hears that horses have been outlawed because you can't eat them, you can't do anything with them. And because in the north we get everything last, we still have the last horse in the UK. So she agrees to come home. Paula would not come home for his sister's wedding or his other sister's baby or the possibility of seeing firsthand all his growing up places. Vicky Park, where he'd learnt to ride a bike, weaving his way through the swans and vicious grey-legged geese, the sweetie shop in Ballyhack, the bus shelter at the Hollywood Arches, where he'd had his first dry kiss, and the alley opposite, where, later that night, the same girl had let him slip the tongue in. Paula was not tempted by the scenery, even when he showed her pictures on the internet. Together, they watched television programmes which had been filmed at home on account of the tax breaks and the lovely scenery. "Look at it," he said. "Isn't it gorgeous?" Paula looked hard at the hills and the windswept beaches. Eventually, she said, "It's okay, I guess. There are better beaches in Spain, and it is not raining on those beaches." Paula would not come home for a dirty weekend at the port or half term in the mountains or even the 12th, which he tried to sell as a genuine cultural experience. No matter what he said or implied, love, duty, some kind of unspoken "I love you big time," Paula would not come home with him. In his outside head, he told himself, "Never mind, you only want her home so everyone can see you have an exotic continental girlfriend now, so all the lads will be jealous, embarrassed by their own doughy women." In his inside head, he knew he was softer than this. He understood, without admitting, the desire to have everything he loved together in one place. Paula would not come home for anything he said or did. Until one day, he heard from his mother on the telephone that they still had horses in Belfast.
Okay, there we go. Jan Carson reading from her story quickly while they still have horses, and she's going to make her trip to Belfast on the basis of that. I was struck in that story when I was reading it, Jan, the number of times the word "not" appears close to Paula's name. She would not do that. She does not do this. She does not like this. Everything is not. She's not the most positive person in the world. I suppose this feeds into that overall sense of disappointment, because, you know, the boyfriend here kind of comes to realize that perhaps this is not the perfect situation that he's in.
Yeah, I guess there's a number of stories where we're seeing an outsider's perspective on the north, and that's a technique that I deliberately employed. We've got a Spanish girlfriend here. There is an English journalist who comes to write an article about the riots, and I use them to kind of almost deflate some of my thoughts about here. I love this place. Yes, these stories are dark and there are a lot of difficult, problematic things about the north, but this is home for me and I'm very proud to be from here and I love it. Sometimes you kind of can't see the wood for the trees, and it takes an outsider to come in and say, "Why does everything close at 5 o'clock?" And yes, she's got like a wonderful cinema, but there are not very many cinemas here, and there's still a lot of problems up here. And that's what I'm using the outsiders to do. And it's very tongue in cheek. And sometimes I go back and I undermine the outsiders and say, like, "Yous are blinkered. You can't see how wonderful the people are here."
Well, funny enough, as you were reading the section about him describing the landscape, I could almost see your eyes going misty, Jan, as you were reading that little section from the story. I got the sense of your love of the place you're from very much across that. Another important strand throughout the book is the idea of faith healing. It comes up a couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll be very honest. I did a wee sneaky thing when I was writing The Raptures. Chekhov wrote short stories apparently about each of his short stories to get the characters right. So he would write a short story to develop the character before he put them in the end product. And I did that with the children in The Raptures. So I wrote into their world the summer before the novel was set. And that gave me a really good grounding in them before I wrote the book. And there are actually five of the stories that were the kind of background stories to the Raptures are in this collection. So most of the rural work went into the Raptures, and there's such a big theme of healing and the miraculous and faith in the Raptures. That's possibly what's leaking through in these stories.
Yeah, in fact, I wondered about, because the Adgers are a set of healers that come to one of the houses in one of the stories, and that's the same family name as Hannah, isn't it?
Yeah, that's well spotted there.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Easter egg that I planted to
There you
get out.
go. Because I thought, I know that name from somewhere, and that's where I knew it from. But the aspect of the other aspect that I wanted to just discuss about it before we go is the character of Victor Soda from the story. It is the same name, isn't it? His story is called Victor Soda. Yeah, it is. This is some chap.
Yeah, I think that's probably the darkest thing that I've ever written, and I guess it's quite an exaggerated story, and there are themes of sexual abuse and some really dark things in that story, but it's mostly about the kind of environment that a lot of us grew up in the 70s and 80s, where in evangelical circles, people just didn't talk about sex or bodies or honestly about kind of what it was like to be a sexual being with a body. And in those environments, it's very easy for bad people like Victor Soda to step into the gaps. It's so important that we talk to our children honestly and openly, just so that they can be aware of what's going on in the world and how to protect themselves. So I guess that story came from trying to write about that. And I hope there is no one actually out there like Victor Soda.
No, I sincerely hope not as well. We don't need to go into the specifics of what he does, but when we say it's pretty dark, it is, I think, one of the darkest things of yours that I've read.
I think so. But I also like, and this is not a spoiler really, but the little girl in the end of it has a real feistiness, and he doesn't get away with anything. Like, she keeps him in his place. I guess, I mean, we've talked a lot tonight about the darkness in the stories, but there's also a lot of hope there and a lot of resilience and, a fair amount of humor too. That's often the coping mechanisms that these characters are using to deal with their disappointments. And
Yeah, I. In fact, I want. I'll finish up with a little, if I can find the specific quote I'm looking for. There's a great little section in one of the stories. I'm flicking through my pages to see if I can find it now. But yes, here I have it. This is the crowd that goes swimming, and they feel that there's a woman who has healing power. She gets climbs into the water, which is the story that I'm talking about. There, coasters, isn't it? Is the story
Oh
that I'm
no,
talking.
Trouble in the Water, it's
Troubling
called.
the water, troubling the waters, and there's they all want to see this woman getting into the water, and they think, God, we all better get in. We might get healed. Nobody wanted to be the first one in. It was important to maintain an air of nonchalance. You couldn't let the others see you'd come here looking to get healed, for you'd only feel a right idiot when it didn't happen. And this is the bit that I love. There'd been a similar standoff last November when Poundland ran a Black Friday special on selection boxes. There's so much Ulster in that last sentence. It's not funny, John. It's hilarious.
I'm quite fond of that story, and it's set in the Templemore Baths, which is just down the road from me. And the amount of people that have told me like stories about curtain in the Templemore Baths and things that they've done in the Templemore Baths since it came out. So yeah, it's been lovely. That one of the things I love about these stories, Sean, is they're very rooted in place, and
Yeah.
people have their own personal associations and memories with these places. So it feels like a bit of a gift to give them
So,
back to them as well.
did you get any of the special selection boxes in Poundland on Black Friday?
No, but I did. I actually witnessed something like that when I was in there, like when, the year I was writing that, and I thought, I'm putting that in a story. That's brilliant.
Jan, lovely to talk with you as always, and congratulations on the collection.
Thank you.
That's Jan Carson and her short story collection, Quickly While They Still Have Horses, is out now. It's published by Doubleday. New Music Dublin is an annual festival dedicated to innovative new music and sound art. Kicking off this year's festival is a performance that brings together the works, the worlds of music, poetry and theatre. Featuring actors Owen Rowe and Aisling O'Sullivan, There Will Be No Silence is a collaborative work by Emmy nominated, I beg your pardon, composer David Downes and poet Adam Wyeth. It reveals the complex inner workings of a couple's shared world. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by David and Adam. And I know that it's There Will Be No Silence, because I heard you saying this on something I watched
that's the
online.
way I say it.
Yeah,
You can say it any way you want.
What way do you say it, Adam Wyeth, poet?
There will be no silence.
Oh, there will be no silence. he's very democratic in his beats across the words there. Tell us where the title comes from, because it's a great story.
Well, I mean, yeah, we're kicking around this idea, and we were talking about various things about how we wanted to do this project together, using my words and obviously David's music, and we were talking about titles and that sort of. No, actually, we were talking about whether there should be. I was asking if there was going to be silence in between and that sort of thing. And David, we were on the phone, and David said, no, there will be no silence. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting title.
Quite abruptly, as I remember. And then the response was, oh, that's a good title.
It was a working title, and it kind of stuck.
It just stuck.
But it informed.
I was just going to ask you that, because I'm sure you wouldn't have kept it as a title just because it was a good moment in a telephone conversation. How did it inform the textual side, the word side of the project, first of all, Adam?
Well, it was kind of it fed into so there will be no silence. We were thinking of the relationship and also how the words work, it was a sort of shadow side, I suppose.
Yeah,
it was
there in the background of things all the time.
Yeah.
And I guess that is what I mean. Music is made up of not only the pitches and the notes.
That's what they say.
The gaps, the gaps in between.
Silence is the important bit. I think it also kind of brings up the nature of sort of contrast. And I mean, it's something that I'm mildly obsessed with in music is kind of contrast. The simple, the high, the low, the loud, the quiet, you know, and in this piece that sort of really got extended into, we have two amazing musicians, Ralph Hind and Adrian Manto, cellist. Both of them really, I mean, just incredible. And so there's the relationship between the two of them and the music, the two actors, Owen Rowe and Aisling O'Sullivan, the chair of the stage with them, and then the relationship between sort of the musicians and the actors. So the sort of nature of relationships sort of builds throughout the whole arc of the piece, and these sort of nebulous ideas start to kind of take root.
Gelled, yeah. So did you think then, Adam, of the characters, are all the texts are your texts?
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you think of these as two characters? Were you almost, in inverted commas, writing a play?
No, not really. And it kind of just came together naturally. And I suppose it was even like when we got Owen Rowe and Aisling O'Sullivan, it kind of just grew from that, the relationship-wise. Because there was this idea of, there's one piece called Rough Music.
Mm.
And so different. So we were playing with this idea of music and sound. But then, because we had these male and female voices and what was kind of working off each other, then a relationship started to develop. So it wasn't like a sort of opera narrative or that sort of thing, but it is there, and it is kind of it's there in the relationship. So it kind of grew from that.
And while we have sections of text, and there's some kind of what I would call a kind of a soundscape and musical undertone, it's not a piece of music that's playing with gaps for the words to fit in. It's a textural thing.
I mean, I always find it quite distracting if you try and combine poetry and music, which we are doing. But if you plonk one on top of the other and you have a piece of music with somebody, you know, reciting poetry on top, do you listen to the poetry? Do you listen to the music?
Yeah.
It just seems to me to be not the best way to do it. So they're a little bit delineated, but the musicians get a lot of freedom in the passages where we hear the poetry, and you know, they're drawing from the well of the music that's following, but they can extemporize, ad lib essentially as much as they want. So they're reacting to the poetry as it's performed, and then the actors are reacting to the music that they hear in return.
So it's kind of like a jazz improvisation,
where the
words are, the text is the kind of the structure that's in place, but the music or the sounds that are coming underneath it has more freedom.
Yeah.
There's a lovely story. This has a true aspect to it. I'm going to play the old piano. I want to play that. I love this section of the show.
Oh, thanks. This one, when I was living in Rathmines, there was an old piano that was thrown out on Leinster Lane, and it was just kind of, you know, this beautiful piano. And as I walked past, you know, each day I kind of, you know, expected it to be gone, but it just got older and older. So it kind of just grew out of that. And yeah, I kind of thinking about it became then a metaphor, I suppose, for, yeah.
Yeah, let's have a listen to the old piano.
What happened to the old piano that was put out on Leinster Lane? It sat there for days doing nothing. Some stopped and clinkered with its keys that were stiff and roomy. Clearly no one had looked after the piano in years. Now, someone, making space, thought it time to sling it all together. Many flirted with the prospect of salvaging it, taking it home, tuning it, bringing it back to its former glory. Someone must take it. But, like passing a rough sleeper who we assume will be taken in, no one ever did. And it was left to weather and rot in the wet October. One day, it started to be stripped down by some language students living across the road in a studio, but in fact paying through the teeth for a damp bedsit with the same 80s furniture and wallpaper. But at least they had the good sense to make use of it. Hammering out a final tune as they ripped off the boards and yanked out the keys as if removing teeth. Do old pianos make different sounds to other kinds of timber? Do they echo the many diminuendos and crescendos once played as hammers and strings fizzle in the flames? Or do we just imagine it? In the end, is the imagined music of useless sound any different to what we call the real thing? Now the piano is gone. There's an empty space. No one will know there was a piano on the lane. There is no piano on Leinster Lane.
And that's The Old Piano, one of the sections from the show we're talking about this evening, There Will Be No Silence, from composer David Downes and poet Adam Wyeth. It was Owen Rowe's voice that we heard there. And the cello playing of Adrian Mantu and the piano playing of
Rolf Hind.
Yeah. I mean, both the way the words and the music fit together, you were describing it, we were talking about it as we were listening, it's kind of like a jazz solo, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
or a jazz improvisation where the piano, the music is really reacting to the words.
Yes, and it's never going to be the same any two times, you know. And a lot of those techniques that you would have heard, knocking and, you know, strange wooden sounds, that's coming from the piano. So Rolf Hind, our pianist, is, you know, it's one of the things that he does. He specializes in contemporary music. So a lot of it is reaching into the piano and knocking it and plucking it and dampening strings and hitting keys.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of techniques going on there. So,
we have, I think it's, is it 8 or 9 pieces of text, somewhere in that region. And then you have musical movements in between those text sections.
That's right.
So explain to me, where do those musical movements pick up on what they've just heard, or is it the other way around?
Well, they do and they don't. I mean, I was very keen when we were discussing this piece that I would be influenced by Adam's writing, and I hoped that perhaps in return then, you know, that some of my early demos would influence the later pieces of his. So we kind of played this game of tic-tac or whatever, and it you know, when you're writing music, it's hard when you start because you've got the blank manuscript and the sharpened pencil, and then you stare at it for, you know, 3 weeks and you sharpen the pencil some more. And so to have something to kind of kick you, you know, to push you out of the airplane with your parachute on, hopefully, is really helpful. So to get a text, it sort of unlocks. It's a little trick, I suppose. It unlocks the brain freeze that
it
gives you something to kind of think. Oh, that, you know.
But David's very good as well of making sense of my text. Like, I could send him like drafts of kind of sort of stream of consciousness stuff, and he can kind of make sense of a lot of it and then sort of pull the best bits out. So that was sort of...
And when you would hear, say, a musical reaction, if you like, to a set of draft bits and pieces that you'd sent to him, would that help clarify the writing of the text backwards for you, if you know what I mean.
It was a mix, really, because, I mean, I was sending you a lot of stuff. And I mean, some of them are poems that have been published as well, like this one piece, Silent Music, which is the title of my first collection.
Your first collection, yeah.
So it was a matter, when it started to come together, and then the There Will Be No Silence, it kind of developed from that. So it was a mixture of grabbing bits and pieces that I was sending, and then... Yeah, so it all kind of grew organically, if you like.
Because when you hear that first collection, Silent Music, was the title of your first collection, you know, you didn't know then that this was going to happen now.
No.
You know, it's amazing how those themes come back.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? When you write something, you don't know where it's going to land or be. And, yeah, to have, like, Aisling O'Sullivan reading your work, you know, and Owen Roe, it's just like they make any line sound brilliant. So it's a gift.
I want to listen to one of the purely musical sections of the work, and this is from the Slow Movement. Maybe tell us some of the ideas that were coming to you in this section of the composition, David.
Yeah, this is a lot of the piece is very, very rhythmic, and I'm kind of drawing on, you know, the
you played percussion, actually, I think, Adam, did you?
I used to be a percussionist, yeah. I mean, before I started writing, yeah, classical tabla was the last thing I played, which was invented by a poet, actually. So there's a connection, I think, between that.
Yeah, and a lot of the poetry is quite rhythmic, yeah. And a lot of the music is something that I'd be drawn to, would be kind of very rhythmic music. But this is a kind of a moment of serenity, or some kind of serenity. It's sort of, the idea is really, I suppose, a thread, and if you can imagine one long thread, and if you sort of poke at the thread, it sort of undulates, and the undulations then sort of build up and up and up, and the whole piece starts to wobble.
Yes,
and
it has that feel.
And sometimes it kind of stops wobbling for a moment, and then it wobbles again. And I'm not sure that's a
I'm asking you to describe a piece of music. I suppose the only way you can describe a piece of music is to listen to it. It's hard to describe.
Better
it
to listen words. Than describe it. But that was kind of the thinking behind it, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's have a listen. This is part of the Slow Movement, then. Gives us an idea there, David Downes, of that's part of the Slow Movement from the work There Will Be No Silence from Adam Wyeth and David Downes, who are with me in studio this evening. And this will be opening the New Music Dublin Festival later, is early next week, actually, isn't it?
It's Thursday.
Thursday of next week. I'm kind of, I've left myself with a little bit less time than I wanted for Pinter's Pause. But tell me about Pinter's Pause, because it was inevitable, I suppose, if you were going to bring theatre, if you like, and music together, that Pinter was going to be in there somewhere, and pauses were going to be mentioned, Adam.
Yeah, well, I'm a big Pinter fan, big Beckett fan, and that's lovely with that piece, because that's when we hear the voices of Aisling and Owen together. But it came out of reading a play in the garden, and just kind of grew from that, really. But it was also, I suppose, it's exploring the language in different ways. Every piece does that, and because Pinter was sort of so conscious of the bully in the room and that sort of thing, that it plays into all the subtext beneath this relationship that's going on.
Yeah, and I'll finish up by listening to certainly a section of Pinter's Pause, but you were telling a great story about, I think it was during the recording of this, how Aisling O'Sullivan was leaning back against the cellist's back and getting all of those vibrations.
Yeah, they were back to back. It's the way, you know, we had them seated on a piano stool back to back, and as he played the cello, she felt all the vibrations.
Yeah, and so that must have fed into the performance. We listen to at least a section here then of Pinter's Pause from There Will Be No Silence.
It was the height of summer. We sat in the garden reading a play. I played her and you played him. Before long, you said...
Do you know about Pinter's pause? Those silent moments, pregnant with words unsaid.
I wasn't really listening. I thought I saw a fox in the undergrowth, stopping by the hedge to eye up his purple gloves.
Everything was in flower. We read the play right the way through. I was him. She was you.
Looking up during each pause, I imagined him creeping beyond our garden, wriggling onto the gap in the fence.
Behind the clematis and convolvulus, or whatever it was.
The twist of hedgerow, the turn in the lane, the height of the day. Just then, everything stopped. Caught between the hands of a clock. The sun was at its zenith. I thought, if I put my hand out, I could catch it and put it in my pocket.
I didn't want to say anything. To break the spell.
Then it moved on. Like a great cog in a grandfather clock. The season was passing. Our lives were turning before its eyes. Those soft paws padding the undergrowth, gingerly treading between the hedgerows, beyond the clematis and convolvulus.
And there we go, a little section, most of there, of Pinter's Pause from There Will Be No Silence. Adam Waith and David Downs, thanks so much for coming into us this evening. And that show, There Will Be No Silence, will be at the, Silence rather, will be at the National Concert Hall Thursday the 25th of April. It's a lunchtime show, opening performance of the New Music Dublin Festival, newmusicdublin.ie for full details. Blue Raincoat Theatre Company is one of Ireland's longest-running full-time professional theatre ensembles and still one of its most experimental and innovative. In the past, they've produced such shows as Shackleton and The Third Policeman. In 2022, they premiered The Last Pearl, a visual art show that uses the likes of skilled models as well as bunraco and shadow puppetry. The Last Pearl is loosely based on the ideas of the environmentalist James Lovelock. And joining us from our Sligo studio this evening, before the show opens in Sligo, then Dublin, and travels off to Glasgow and Edinburgh, our director Niall Henry, Sandra O'Malley and Ashley Mannion, both of whom take part in the show. Niall, it's hard to talk about, is there a story or is there a narrative in The Lost Pearl? Because I saw a version of it as it was shown in the factory. I saw a filmed version of that, but it really struck me as I was watching it. This is a very immersive experience, I would guess, in terms of theatre. How do you describe, I suppose, what that lost pearl is, to start out with, or The Last Pearl?
Well, I suppose the story is, Sean, a simple story. It's a woman and her daughter, and they're living alone in a little stilt house in the middle of a vast sea, and she's a pearl diver, and the world around her, through storms and through things that are, you know, people throw away, the detritus gathering up in the seabed bit by bit, she finds it more and more difficult to survive, I suppose. And we didn't have all this sort of in our heads when we set out. It was bit by bit we were devising it. And then she discovers a thing, and she uses that, and that's how they survive. So I suppose metaphorically it's how we all survive, but it's like it's nearly like an Aesop's fable. It's a simple story in its action, and hopefully richer in what it delivers.
Maybe just to give me briefly a little bit about the environmentalist James Lovelock, who I think was very important in terms of the early devising stages of this show.
Well, he died in 2019, and he was a sort of a funny guy. He was the guy, people might know him, but he was the guy who discovered the hole in the ozone layer way back. He was the guy who came up with the idea of Gaia, where, you know, the Earth was a sort of self-regulating organism. System, and but he wasn't a very popular environmentalist, because he was always very pro-nuclear, because he always thought that it was the only clean, real energy to hand. And sorry, Sean.
You're okay.
And he was a sort of a funny guy, and his basic thesis was that we've destroyed everything, and it's just not going to go well. And we just have to go deal with that fact. And he was starting from that principle. And when he would say things like that, he'd laugh. Like, so he wasn't a dour, sad man. You know what I mean? Yeah. He was quite a good humour character. So we wanted to do something around that, and we weren't really sure. And this was just before I think it was 1919 he died. And it was just before the pandemic. And we did a couple of little workshops, and we had an idea, which I won't go into now because it was too bad. And the guy we worked with, Jocelyn Clark, he's a drama. And in early 2022, when we decided that we were going to go into rehearsal later on that year, he just turned around and said, like, you know, this isn't working. The idea that we had wasn't working. And then, of course, speaking for myself, I was panicking because we had to go and devise a play that autumn. And the work we had prepped just wasn't working out, and so we came up with a system where I would ring him on a Friday, and I'd have five ideas, and he would throw his eyes up to heaven down the phone over the five ideas, and I think it was the fifth or sixth Friday, so we'd gone through 2025. You know, you're going through little notes looking for anything, I wasn't editing. Yeah. You know, I was throwing anything I could think of at him, and then my daughter actually, and I had told her, and she had said to me, she was listening to Mitski at the time. Mitski was the who she was into at the time, and Mitski had a song called The Pearl Diver. So her Phoebe turned around and said, "Dad, what about that?" So I stuck that in the list because I couldn't find five ideas for that Friday. And lo and behold, Justin went, "Oh, I like the idea of The Pearl Diver." So we started off really, Sean, because we were stuck at this stage, and we had a workshop, and we tried, how would we do underwater, and how would we do, you know, the four or five things that strike you, like, what's going to be difficult here, and we found a little idea how to pull that off, and we went into rehearsal with four or five little elements, but elements we were confident with. And to link back to the Lovelock thing, when we finished devising it, in a way, the story we told pointed a lot to the positive side of Lovelock, you know, the thing of that we're living in a really difficult space, it's only going to get more difficult, but we really just have to make the best of it, you know what I mean, and try to look at cold in the eye and do our best to survive that, you know. So it wasn't on purpose in the end, but it did end up absolutely in the end.
And Sandra O'Malley, you've been with Blue Raincoat for quite a while now. So perhaps that kind of, as Niall describes it there, the kind of the terror of the empty space, if you like, to mix up the metaphors there between page and stage, the terror of that, no ideas and going into a rehearsal room. I'm sure you're quite used to that with Blue Raincoat, where sometimes that is, you start with nothing and see where you go from there.
Indeed, Sean, how you doing? High drama on a low budget, we call it down here in the Northwest. So, yes, indeed. Well, one thing we did have from day one, we had a rather large table. We had bamboo sticks. We had lots of kind of cardboard, paper, tape, a lot of tape. We had various things in which we could literally sort of do a little mock-up of maybe a little paper boat and attach it to a stick, or, you know, a little jellyfish, or little cutouts of things that we could use, and we could use with light. We had sort of mobile spotlights, so you would isolate certain little scenes for her underwater, or we had our screen where we had our kind of life-size actor play almost like a puppet herself, you know, in terms of shadow.
Yeah, because there's a section there, a couple of times during the show, we get this image up on a window high up, or in a space, an open space high up, of a silhouetted figure against the window.
Exactly.
Which, again, echoes that type of puppetry idea that you're speaking about, Sandra. Would you explain about, in layman's terms, Bunraku puppetry to us, and what's involved there and how that has fed into this show?
Bunraku, I understand, as being like puppets that are operated by sticks. So they would have been sort of Japanese. And that's kind of the route that we decided to go down because of the fact that we needed our puppet to swim and underwater, you know, for her scavenging and all of the things that she does beneath the surface. So it takes... Well, it's certainly in our play, there are three of us operating the puppet. So one on the arms, one on the body and the head, and one on the legs. So Yeah, essentially it's a stick puppet, and we have her a little bit larger than you would imagine the little stick puppets to be. So you give her, you know, she can go nice lengths with her strokes and her dives and things like that, you know, and thankfully we had a really good puppet made, lost a few limbs along the way, but we put her back together every time.
Yeah, I mean, as we're describing it here, it's important for me to stress just how visually beautiful the show is, because it is a beautiful thing to look at. Even looking at it on a screen, I can only imagine what it was like in its reality. Aisling, then, Aisling Mannion, who's in our Sligo studio as well, I think you're new enough to Blue Raincoat, to the company. Is this a very different experience from, I suppose, perhaps, I know you have a background in movement for sure, but to the more traditional theatre that you may have performed in previous exploits?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything can really prepare you for working with Blue Raincoat, but I have a background in theatre, and I suppose the basic foundation of training. But when I began working with Blue Raincoat, I was introduced to corporal mime, and I really found a path to follow with that. But it is very different. I don't think, as a student, you really understand how to implement all that you're learning until you start working with a company. And to work with a company that's been together for such a long time, and they all know each other so well, and they've brought so much experience from their previous shows forward to this one. It's just been such a pleasure.
And yes, you have worked in physical theatre before, but that idea of the absence to a large extent of a text, the absence in some ways of a character, even in terms of what you're doing, the character is maybe the puppet or it's this silhouetted figure. I think you're that silhouetted figure. I'm guessing, but perhaps you're not. But yes, I thought it was possibly you. Okay, but the absence of those, I suppose, traditional tools of the actor. How frightening is it? How liberating is it?
I think it's personal to every performer. I find it really, really liberating. What's really interesting about The Last Pearl is that, you know, we don't have text and we don't have, you know, a standard scene, you know, where, you know, man, woman come in, have a conversation and they leave the room. But we are very much part of the story as makers, you know.
Yes.
You see us sort of in the transitions between scenes, and we're creating the scene for you, and we're not trying to hide that. It's there's an honesty to that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, even if I describe the opening where there are large, it's kind of, they look like silk sheets across the width, width of the stage, and it struck me that, I'm sure, Niall, there was a lot of time spent working out exactly how to flick that piece of silk to get precisely the sense of a wave going across the stage. And then when all of the different silk sheets start to interact with each other to create a storm, nothing is happening by accident. This is highly choreographed, I'm guessing.
It is, but it, like, a huge amount of it is trial and error, you know. And you know, there's a I suppose the one rule is everyone's trying to get the, let's say, the silk to work, and eventually someone gets it to work and everyone else starts copying.
Learns from that.
You know, exactly. And then someone else has got to, you know, gets a little bit better and we start copying them, you know, and that's it.
And briefly, Niall, I mean, that idea of the non-textual theatre, yes, of course, Blue Raincoat have done plays with text. I'm not saying that that's all that you do is non-textual theatre, but it always strikes me that kind of seems where you're totally at home.
Strangely, it does. This is our fourth one, and it does.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me. Listen, thanks to all three of you for coming into our Sligo studio this evening. That's Niall Henry, Sandra O'Malley, and Aisling Mannion discussing the Blue Raincoat production, The Last Pearl. The show will be on from the 22nd to the 26th of April at the Factory in Sligo. Then from April the 29th to May the 11th, it will be at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin before travelling to the Tron in Glasgow and the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh at the end of May and into June. Full information on the company's website, blueraincoat.com. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Fake No Brain On will be with you after the news.